loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, we discuss a bill that Hawaii Democrat Tulsi Gabbard and North Carolina Republican Walter Jones introduced recently that would refer for impeachment any U.S. president who starts or initiates a war without the necessary authorization from the U.S. Congress. And then we continue our weekly Tuesday series called False Prophets, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with Daniel Sankey. Today we discuss elder care, the 2.5 billion pounds of meat that are now sitting in a warehouse instead of being eaten because it's more profitable, and how Portugal's non-austerity approach has led to a healthy economy compared to the austerity in the rest of Europe.
But before we get to those two stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, in two parts, Senator Rand Paul, a Kentucky Republican, yesterday asked President Trump to revoke the security clearances of six former Obama administration intelligence officials who have been harshly critical of the president. Trump is considering the request, but why do former officials with no governmental responsibility, who are now employed by media outlets, have security clearances in the first place? Next is the second half of that conversation. Then, as the Senate continues its deliberation on passing the enormous $717 billion defense spending bill for 2019, new details continue to emerge. The bill is likely to include a number of provocative policies aimed at turning up pressure on Russia, including allocating $250 million for lethal military aid to Ukraine. And then the Israeli military said today that it had shot down a Syrian fighter jet after it entered Israeli airspace, an allegation the Syrian government denies. The announcement sparked fears of a widening conflict. And finally, the Trump administration said today that 463 immigrant parents may already have been deported without their children, adding yet another stumbling block to the reunification of families in advance of a court-ordered deadline to do so on Thursday. And in other headlines, leaders of the BRICS countries, that is Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, are arriving in Johannesburg to take part in the bloc's annual summit today. International trade is expected to be a main agenda item as the BRICS aim to counter the protectionist policies of the Trump administration. The summit formally gets underway tomorrow. At least 74 people are dead and 187 still missing as a result of out-of-control wildfires outside Athens, Greece. The fires are affecting areas immediately outside of the city, including the villages of Mati, Rafina, and Kineta. The cause of the fires has yet to be determined. While addressing the veterans of foreign wars today, President Trump remarked, quote, "We'll see what happens, but we're ready to make a real deal, not the deal that was done by the previous administration, which was a disaster," unquote, referring to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the Iran nuclear deal. This is amid an intense rhetorical back and forth between Trump and Iranian President Rouhani. House of Representatives Speaker Paul Ryan said today that if Russian President Putin comes to visit the White House, he will not be invited to address Congress, saying that is a privilege only for allies. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to Capitol Hill. Two longtime war critics in the House of Representatives sponsored a bill last week that says any president should face impeachment for waging war without a formal declaration from Congress. Tulsi Gabbard, a Hawaii Democrat, and Walter Jones, a North Carolina Republican, say that unauthorized military action should be considered a high crime and misdemeanor. We're joined here in the studio by the author of that bill, Attorney Bruce Fine. He's a constitutional law scholar and former Assistant Deputy Attorney General of the United States. And we're joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst Walter Smolarek. Welcome, both of you.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Bruce, let's start with you. Tell us what the impetus of this bill was.
Well, the impetus goes back about 70 years. Until that time, it was understood by all lawyers and the executive branch and members of Congress that the president could not initiate war, take the nation from a state of peace to war, unless Congress had declared it. I know that you referenced it as a formal declaration. I think that trivializes the importance. Unless you can get a consensus of the legislative branch to agree that we should turn our legal architecture from peace to war, and war, after all, is legalizing first-degree murder, That is, you can kill not in self-defense. There is no justification for going to war. In fact, that's one of the worst things that can happen to a nation. A nation's genius migrates from production to killing. It's enormously expensive. The executive branch goes from transparency to secrecy. Privacy is destroyed with indiscriminate surveillance. There is no due process of law. A president plays judge, jury, prosecutor, and executioner to kill people that he believes are national security threats without accountability. So those are very, very serious consequences of going to war. So finally, in 1920, the United States Senate rejected the Versailles Treaty, the League of Nations Treaty, that was presented by President Woodrow Wilson, precisely because he refused to accept a reservation. It was called Lodge Reservation 2, that made clear that the United States would not defend the borders of any other country by military means unless Congress had declared war. And we had that understanding that the war power rested with Congress, not the president, up until the Korean War, where Harry Truman described as a police action, a conflict that ultimately involved over 5 million American soldiers, 3 million Chinese soldiers, millions of Korean soldiers, casualties ranging into the millions, and the prospect of nuclear war. And he said that was a police action, not a war, and he didn't get any congressional authorization for it. And since Korea, the United States has engaged in countless what I would call presidential wars. It's part of the concentration of power that has accumulated as we migrated from a republic to an empire wishing to dominate the whole world, like other empires have done, including the Russian Empire in its prime, the Roman Empire, the Ottoman Empire, all of them. That meant that the Congress no longer declared war. Sometimes it would say nothing, and presidents go to war, as President Trump is doing in Syria at present, or President Obama did in Libya. We still have troops in Libya, still have no declaration of war. And sometimes Congress has just given the war power away, which they're not entitled to do. For example, giving President W. Bush authority to invade Iraq, saying, we don't want to decide, you can decide on your own. And our Supreme Court has said repeatedly, one branch of government can't give its power away to another branch, because the reason why we have separation of powers is to protect the American people from the tyranny that comes from the consolidation of power, not to protect the vanity of one branch or another. So that's kind of the background. For 70 years, the war power has rested with the president. Even today, for example, recent news about President Trump threatening Iran with war, and assuming, and I think the American people assume, I think the mainstream media assumes, the president go to war on his own against Iran or against North Korea or against China or Russia. He doesn't have that power. He could do it, but it would be illegal, a crime against the Constitution, what the resolution that I drafted styles a high crime and misdemeanor, for which he could be impeached in the House, that takes a majority vote, convicted in the Senate by 2/3 votes, and removed from office. Now, one of the things that this resolution does, however, it's kind of a benefit to the president. For 228 years, the House of Representatives has never attempted to define, you know, what is a high crime and misdemeanor, what's an impeachable offense. We once had minority leader in the House, Gerald Ford, before he was president, say it's whatever a majority wants it to be. But that's equally arbitrary and wrongheaded. Mm-hmm. You can't have the presidency held to whatever the House of Representatives wants to decree retroactively is bad conduct. You have to give fair warning. That's the ingredient of due process. And so the House resolution doesn't apply retroactively. It applies prospectively. Indeed, it could apply in the inauguration of 2020 presidential campaign so that no one can argue it's just targeted at Trump, because it's not. In fact, I've been working on this idea for well over 10 years. So it doesn't matter who is in the White House. Presidents have gone to war on their own because that's what executive branches do. They're like a pit bull personality, not a laboratory retriever. Anything that moves, they want to attack because it gives them power. So we have the bill introduced, and now we need to get a majority in the House to pass it. We think it's an uphill battle because we've been this empire mentality for a long time. It's very difficult to get persons who have their entire life, they've grown up thinking presidents can go to war on their own. Neither the mainstream media, the New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, none of them are constitutionally literate. They all propagate this nonsense, even it's when the president is someone they don't like. So this is to try to get back to our constitutional moorings, what we could call normal constitutional order, to borrow from Senator John McCain. It's going to take a long time because we've been down the wrong road for close to 70 years, probably had at least two dozen presidential wars with impunity. Congress does nothing because their attitude is, well, if the war goes south, we'll blame the president. I don't want to take responsibility for this. It's a bad campaign issue. Let's run away from it. That's not something you should be in Congress saying if you want to serve. You have an obligation as a member to uphold and defend the Constitution. If you don't want to do that, you ought to leave.
Bruce, Congress hasn't declared war in 77 years, not since December the 8th, 1941, nearly 77 years. What's the difference between a declaration of war and a congressional authorization for the use of force? We saw that in 2002 for the invasion of Iraq. We saw it in 1990 with the liberation of Kuwait. What's the difference between the two?
Well, it's enormous. It's Alexander Hamilton, among others, and he was the founding father who was in favor of the most muscular president, said the plain meaning of the Declare War Clause is only the Congress can take the nation from a state of peace to war. They have to make that decision. Actually, in 228 years, Congress has only made that decision five times. And in each of those occasions, they actually didn't take the nation from peace to war. They acknowledged that we had been placed in war by a foreign aggressor. The War of 1812, it was Great Britain. Mexican-American War, it was Mexico. Spanish-American War, it was Spain. World War I, it was Germany. World War II, it was Japan. And then Hitler declared war on the United States before our Congress acknowledged, okay, we're at war. He declared war against the United States. Because the key is that the Congress has no artificial ulterior motive for going to war needlessly because it doesn't get any power. It has to write home to the men and women who died in their district, to the families explaining why they died. So they are very cautious about going to war recklessly. If you require them to make the decision, you may recall in 2013, President Obama went to Congress and said, I want you to give me authority to go to war against Syria. This use of chemical weapons that were alleged. Congress wouldn't vote. They wouldn't even vote on anything. They are risk averse, which is what you want when it comes to war. You don't want to have highly risky people in war. But when Congress passes what you have properly styled authorizations to use military force, Congress doesn't take the nation from a state of peace to war. It says in substance to the president, if you think you know you want to go to war, you can do so. So it hands the decision to the president. And the whole purpose of the Declare War Clause is to say, no, we don't want the president. We never want the president to make the decision to go to peace to war. Only Congress to do it. We don't trust the president because he has all these ulterior motives to concoct excuses because the president gets all of the power. Not only that, he gets monuments, footprints in the sands of time. You think you're going to be some kind of a star chapter in the annals of history. So that's exactly the mentality that the founding fathers understood would tarnish any decision by the executive branch. So, and in fact, in 1991, when President H.W. Bush then went to Congress, he said, I don't need your authority, but I want your political support because I'm going to go in and fight anyway. That's what he wrote in his memoir. And when Congress passed the AUMF and after 9/11, it didn't say we're at war with al-Qaeda or anybody. It just says, President, you can decide if you wish to go to war, and runs away. It says, not on my watch from any further. So that's what we're trying to abandon, these authors. Sometimes they say nothing at all. Sometimes they do say, well, you can decide and don't blame us if it goes south because it's your decision. But that's what's wrong, and that's what violates the Declare War Clause purpose, which says a member has to take responsibility for taking us from peace to war, not the executive.
And the post-9/11 authorization for the use of military force, it was worded extremely broadly. I mean, I think it makes reference to al-Qaeda, and, quote, and all associated forces.
Yeah, it doesn't say al-Qaeda. No, it doesn't even reference al-Qaeda. The language of that act, and it was drafted mainly by John Yoo, who believes in virtually limitless presidential power.
He certainly does.
Says that those who were responsible, who were complicit in 9/11, they don't use the words al-Qaeda, or those who harbored them. Now, the fact is, even on those terms, everyone who was involved in 9/11, either is dead or is captured. So there aren't any of those anymore. Now, the idea of associated forces is not in the statutory language. It was invented by courts to say, well, if you're associated force, you're giving them weapons or money or material assistance, then you're also targeted. Now, but I say that's an invention of the executive branch. Congress did not put that language in the AUMF.
And what legally constitutes a war? Because in addition to the, you know, the major confrontations like the Iraq War, the Vietnam War, the Korean War we were talking about a moment ago, there's also been the proliferation of these smaller armed conflicts. For instance, the U.S. Drone bombing campaign in Pakistan, drone wars in Somalia and Yemen, the deployment of U.S. special operations forces all across Africa, I believe perhaps even in the majority of countries of Africa. You know, there are these very, relatively low-level conflicts that the United States has become militarily embroiled in. Are those wars, should those by constitutional process be decided on by Congress?
Yes. You ask, what's the definition of war? One of the first approaches, and it's not definitive, but it's a strong clue. If the country did to the United States what we are doing to them, would we think it was war? That was the standard that was used by Bob Gates when we were prepared to send missiles, a missile attack into Syria. And the then Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates, was asked, well, you know, suppose Syria shot missiles into New York City. Would you consider it war? And he says, well, of course, we would probably incinerate them. So that's a pretty good clue. And in all those instances, if these countries did to us what we are doing to them, we would view that as war. Secondly, there are standards for the definition of wars of aggression. That's both in the Nuremberg trials that postdated World War II. A war of aggression was the use of offensive capability, the military offensive use of the military, not in self-defense, meaning not in response to an actual or imminent attack. And that's amplified a little bit on top. The Rome Statute to the International Criminal Court also has a definition of war of aggression, which includes bombardment, you know, invading the sovereignty of another nation's territory with force or violence, including dropping bombs. Which is what we're doing. Like in Syria, look at all the bombs we're dropping there. And of course, predator drones. We go into Pakistan. We tell them, well, this being given consent. But it really is not. I mean, and it doesn't really matter whether it's consensual anyway. The general definition of war for purposes of the Declare War Clause is the offensive use of the U.S. military, not in self-defense.
Bruce, what happens legally if Congress does declare war on a country, but the United Nations does not authorize a use of force? Let's say, for example, that something happens in Syria. There's a chemical attack on American soldiers that are there, let's say. Well, American soldiers are in Syria illegally. There's been no United Nations Security Council resolution authorizing U.S. forces to be there. So let's say then that Congress does declare war on Syria, but the United Nations doesn't authorize it. What happens then?
The Constitution is superior to a treaty. That's a decision by the U.S. Supreme Court called Reed versus Covert. So a treaty cannot trump the Constitution. Just like you couldn't have a treaty at the UN that said every country has to suppress speech that criticizes any head of state of a UN member. Because our First Amendment would say you can't do that by treaty, right? And that applies to war as well. Our Declare War Clause in our Constitution says Congress can declare war. And if it does so, if it wishes to violate international law, it can do so. And indeed, the Supreme Court has upheld the right of Congress by statute to override treaty obligations. That may expose the United States to international sanctions. But in terms of domestic law here, it would still be legal. Every American complying with a congressional declaration would be operating legally under U.S. law. Now, obviously, the United States can't control all international law, whether there are repercussions outside the United States is unlikely because all coercive action of the United Nations has to pass through the Security Council, and the United States has a unilateral veto, like Russia and China. Yep. and Britain and France. And we would obviously veto any decision that targeted U.S. action.
What's the likelihood of, you know, this bill? Well, I guess I should ask, you know, what are the principal goals behind the introduction of this bill? It's an uphill fight, of course. It's something that I think clearly needs to pass. It's something that, could save a lot of lives all around the world, as well as protect civil liberties and important, rights here in the United States. But do you think that this could also spark a conversation, a public debate that's long overdue?
Well, that's the primary purpose in the short run. Say, we have not had a serious debate over this issue for 70 years. Both the Republican and Democratic parties are equally complicit. And I don't care how liberal or conservative, you can go from Mitch McConnell to Harry Reid, to Chuck Schumer, to Nancy Pelosi, to Paul Ryan. None of them want to debate this issue. They're all in the empire mentality mode. So this is to provide a vehicle to at least spark the debate that you've described, because the law basically is going to follow public opinion. And that's why you have to begin at some point, even if it takes 70 years. It's better than never happens. Sometimes events propel action faster than you might otherwise expect. But I remember, just to give you a historical analogy, when slavery was in its heyday, the House of Representatives had passed a rule saying any abolitionist petition has to be not considered proper and not considered by any committee. John Quincy Adams, who after he left the presidency joined the House of Representatives, that's when the Congress still meant something, because today the idea that a president would go to the House of Representatives is impossible to imagine. You know, he labored for over 12 years opposed. It was called the gag rule that he'd styled, the gag rule against considering anti-slavery petitions. And finally, he prevailed. And it was 12 years. This was before the Civil War. So you can't be despairing simply because it's a long uphill battle. You have to start the conversation somewhere. We have to get the American people back to being constitutionally literate so they know why these provisions are in the Constitution and how they have to enforce it through their own votes. And they can't let Congress be spineless and cowardly and let the president get away with basically raping the Constitution.
War has this insidious way of sort of spreading throughout all of society and infringing, you know, not just on, you know, the constitutional separation of powers, but many of the other rights that are guaranteed in the Bill of Rights to the Constitution, the first 10 amendments. Free speech, we've been talking a lot about, you know, how free speech can be suppressed in the name of a state of war. But I think another major trend that we've seen in society is the rise of mass surveillance and the diminution or perhaps complete elimination of privacy rights as a consequence of this.
The surveillance state is what you have. Yes. There's no doubt that what I consider the warfare state then breeds a surveillance state, an anti-civil liberty state. Because in times of war, the law is silent. The courts simply are not going to step in and defend basic rights. Just think of this to, I think, underscore your observation. This is a very astute one. We live at present with a legal architecture in the United States that endows the president with authority on his own, based on secret evidence that he never shares with anyone, to play prosecutor, judge, jury, and executioner, to kill anybody he decides is an imminent threat. And there's no second guessing. No court gets to second guess it. The Congress doesn't. The American people don't even know the standards he used to decide to kill, to vaporize this particular purpose, this person. That is truly frightening. You cannot even imagine a constitutional violation that's more palpable and gross. He can just vaporize anybody in the world he wants on his own based on secret, and we know how reliable secret evidence is, that nobody else ever gets to see. So you can see, if you've already passed that Rubicon in destroying civil liberties, violations of free speech and privacy seem minor in comparison. But you're absolutely right. The surveillance programs that we have, indiscriminate surveillance, you don't have probable cause, you don't have anything, you don't even investigate crime. We just want to gather up information because we think it could help at some particular point, be the last piece in the jigsaw puzzle that 10 years down the road, you know, may help us stop a terrorist act. Even though all of the surveillance programs have basically yielded nothing when it comes to stopping a terrorist attack. It's virtually useless. In fact, Bill Binney, I think who John knows and maybe has been on the program, has explained to me and in an affidavit, the NSA acquires so much information that their regular officer would have to run through 600 reports a minute just to digest everything they've collected. You couldn't possibly interpret 600 reports a minute. And that's why they complain about overload, and they have, in fact, identified zero prospective terrorist plots that have been thwarted.
Zero. We have about a minute left, Bruce. Let's talk just for that minute about the politics of this resolution. Tell us what kind of support it's getting on Capitol Hill and whether it has any supporters in the Senate.
Well, first, the latter. First, since it's, remember, in the Constitution, only the House does impeachment. The Senate sits as a trier of fact.
That's
right. So it's a little bit awkward for the Senate to be deciding, you know, what they're going to conclude as impartial judges is impeachable or not. So we haven't pushed it hard in the Senate. It's only been introduced for a short period of time, but we think we can get the Progressive Caucus and through additional Dear Colleague letters and maybe to have a hearing on this so that we could have as many as 50 to 80 co-sponsors by the end of this particular Congress. Remember, every bill has only a two-year period before it expires and has to be introduced the next Congress, and so we'll have a new Congress in 2019, so we'll probably come back again and introduce it. But if we could get as many as 50 or 60 this time around. Obviously, the difficulty is many people, because even though this is not targeted at President Trump, doesn't take effect till 2020, they just associate impeachment. They think of the Clinton, Trump, you know, they automatically go crazy because they vastly exaggerated what impeachment is about. They style it like a coup d'etat.
Right.
And listen, I have been involved in every impeachment proceeding, you know, it's my life, 50 years, starting out with Nixon. That's not what happens. Nixon was on the verge of impeachment. The country stayed stable. There's not a military coup. And what happened? Did he go to Siberia like Khrushchev? No. You know, he became an elder statesman. He made money speaking on books and all that. He had a death where it was attended by all these glitterati around the world. No, that is not what impeachment is. Just a conclusion by the Congress. We do not trust you as a steward of our liberties. You have to leave office. There's no criminal punishment. And I say, Bill Clinton, the same. Did impeach? He was acquitted, but he was impeached. He made millions of dollars afterwards. It kind of just went away. No one thinks at all. It at all handicapped him, certainly in his ability to raise money, the Clinton Foundation, or whatever. So we got to get away from this scare tactics and trying to suggest impeachments like, you know, these banana republics in South America or something. It is the civilized way in which you deal with threats to liberty. In fact, Benjamin Franklin at the Constitutional Convention said, impeachment, it's a substitute for tyrannicide.
Well, we can leave it there. We were joined here in the studio by Bruce Fine. Bruce is a constitutional law scholar and a former assistant deputy attorney general of the United States. And we were joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst Walter Smolarek. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Today we continue our weekly series, False Prophets, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with Daniel Sankey. We're joined from San Francisco by Daniel Sankey. He's a financial policy analyst. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So Daniel, let's start with this article you flagged for us from the Wall Street Journal. Its headline is, America is running out of family caregivers just when it needs them the most. Talk about this. Talk about the economics of aging, the social impact of aging, and how society cares for people.
Yeah, this is a really important article. And really what it talks about is how, as the baby boomers continue to age and enter retirement years and enter years when they need, you know, serious care, because of their ages, that we're running out of people to do it. Essentially, what it talks a great deal about is that the vast majority of care for elderly people come from family members, come from the communities around them. And really, what it's observing is that those communities don't have the bandwidth and the availability to care for them like they used to. And there's a number of factors. One is just simply the baby boomer population is especially large, and so it isn't buoyed up by the generation after them in the same way to where there's an extra amount of descendants that can go back and take care of them. But additionally, it talks a lot about how much work has changed and how many of the baby boomer or the generation after the baby boomer are working significantly more and working more jobs to support themselves and don't have the free time and availability. Certainly, dual income families are almost the norm nowadays. It's really uncommon to have where one person is able to be a full-time parent or, in this case, a full-time caregiver. And so what we're seeing is this huge sociological impact of elderly people who will have no one to care for them and for whom elder care facilities are prohibitively expensive. They're incredibly expensive, and both them and their families aren't able to afford them. Additionally, it talks a great deal about the cuts in Social Security and Medicaid, and that they're not paying out to the degree that they're supposed to. And so that further impacts their ability to pay for things and to care for themselves. And really, it's showing it's a crisis for elderly people being able to grow old and pass on with dignity. And that our society now is such that these massive army of unpaid labor, which were people and family members that cared for family members, are drying up and are not available to the way they used to be.
I once spoke to a friend of mine in Thailand who was visiting the United States, and he said that in Thailand, people always said that in the United States, we treat our pets better than we treat our parents. And it was exactly what you're talking about here, that we really don't take care of our elderly parents the way we should. We put them in nursing homes, we put them in assisted living centers, and pay the money and just wish them well. But you're right, Daniel. There's this burgeoning group of people in this age group who are in ill health and have to be taken care of. And we're not really doing it.
Yeah, and especially to speak to your Thai friend, it's very common throughout the world in most cultures that elders are expected to be cared for, and that there is this social consciousness that, of course, we take care of our older generation. It's a point of pride. It's a point of honor and a sense of community. And here in the U.S., more and more, it's becoming that, you know, they become liabilities. They can't work anymore. And we have such a culture that glorifies youth and, you know, looks down its nose at aged people who are out of touch with reality or incompetent when it comes to technology. These sort of characterizations are very typical. And so that further, you know, allows us to have this slip into the society where taking care of them isn't a major priority, where, you know, we can have these exorbitantly unaffordable elder care facilities where we can kind of work the next generation to the bone so they can't even take care of their families anyway. And they can't afford to take care of their families, right? They can't quit a job or quit their job and start taking care of them. They'd be destitute, where this is becoming more common. I think it really speaks to the need for social safety nets. You know, these people contribute to society. They've worked most of their lives and now they're enjoying some well-deserved retirement. They've contributed to our economy. They've contributed to our society. And yet they're being thrown out because, you know, they can't work anymore. And eventually we'll all reach that point where we can't work anymore. And so this is a major crisis. I think it also speaks to, it's a lot like the pharmaceutical industry where these elder care facilities are insanely expensive. You know, it quotes some numbers in there, but, you know, one of them quoted $100,000 a year for a private room. That is a room where a person can actually have their own space and not, you know, have to share it with other people.
My goodness.
Right, which is insanely expensive. I mean, most people don't even make that in a year, let alone, you know, the ability to pay for someone else who isn't able to work anymore. I see this really as these companies, these elder care facilities, will start trying to kind of squeeze every little drop of profit, because this is a little like healthcare. People will pay for it even if it's insanely expensive. They'll do whatever it takes, you know, beg, borrow, or steal, because your health, your life is the most important thing to you. And you can see it in the same way for elderly family members. In this, they are your family, they are your parents or grandparents, and you'll do whatever it takes to try to get them comfortable, to live a life of dignity so they aren't in total destitution. So I can see them really exploiting working people and charging these exorbitant fees for these facilities as a way of, you know, super profiting off of this vulnerable segment of the population.
And it's big business, too. I'm just looking at this list is a couple of years old, but it's a list of the biggest elder care nursing home corporations in the United States. I mean, the top one here, Genesis Healthcare, they have over 50,000 staffed beds. HCR Manor Care is number two. Golden Living is number three. People who work at nursing homes are very frequently paid very low wages. And, you know, there's all sorts of scandals that you hear every once in a while about these nursing homes where, you know, because of cost cutting, you know, the desire to cut corners to maximize profit. The conditions and care that elders get in facilities are very, very low quality.
Yeah, that's a huge thing. I mean, this is an extremely vulnerable population. They may be dealing with certain mental health issues like dementia, where they're not kind of aware of what's going on or not able to advocate for themselves. Their family members, as we've been discussing, have full-time jobs and full-time lives. And while they're able to visit, they're not able to, you know, have them under constant supervision. And so when there are, you know, unacceptably poor conditions or even instances of abuse or violence, they're not able to stand up for themselves. They're not able to advocate for themselves, and they might not even really be aware it's happening. And so these facilities can turn the other way, look the other way on these things and employ the types of people who are maybe not even malicious, but are exhausted and under-resourced and not able to care for them the way they were. They should be. So, you know, people develop bed sores or people miss medication or people miss meals. And, you know, who's going to advocate for them? Who's going to stand up and sue this company for them? The elders are not able to, and their families are frequently not able to either. So it's a hugely exploitable, vulnerable population. And I think that we've only seen the very tip of the iceberg, these scandals of, you know, elderly care facilities abusing their residents. I think that it's much more common than we're aware of and willing to admit.
Well, let's move on to a different topic here. There's 2.5 billion pounds of meat that's piled up in warehouses across the United States. Why don't you tell us what's going on there?
Yeah, I wanted to talk a little bit about kind of production under the current system. What we have is 2.5 billion pounds of meat that is piled up. And the reason is they're not exporting it as quickly and as in great a volume as they would hoped. So people in the U.S. want to buy and eat meat, but not enough people, and the meat industry is very dependent on exports outside the country, and they're not getting purchases like they used to, and this is in part due to tariffs and this kind of trade conflict between the U.S. and other countries. And so what we have is 2.5 billion pounds of meat just sitting on ice, basically, and doing nothing. And I think it's really important to talk about, you know, we talk about hunger, we talk about homelessness, we talk about resources in the United States. And a lot of times the rhetoric is sort of there's not enough to go around. You know, there's limited resources and that's the way it goes. And, you know, if you don't get it, you don't get it. But the truth is this could feed a tremendous amount of people. And it shows our productive capacities in the United States and the industrialized world are tremendous. We can produce huge amounts of food for people. And yet we live in a world where it actually makes more sense to hoard that meat and not feed people who are hungry, who are starving, or providing them, you know, subsidized ways to access that food through, you know, food stamps or things like that. Instead, we hoard it and we sit on it. And in fact, if we flooded the market with this meat, if we started giving it away to people who were hungry, who were homeless, it would destroy the meat industry. The prices would crash, profitability would tank, hundreds of thousands of people would be laid off, et cetera. So we live in a society, in a world where we can actually feed everyone if we wanted to. We can actually house everyone if we wanted to. Hundreds of years ago, this wasn't possible. You know, if there's a famine, you starve to death and that's it. But now we can do that, and it's a technological miracle. And yet, in our current system, producing meat is not for eating. Producing meat is for profit. And right now, even though that meat is good for eating, it's not good for profit because they don't have enough buyers. And so we see this 2.5 billion pounds of meat just, you know, on ice, going nowhere.
Yeah, I'm looking at a report from the nonprofit organization Feeding America, and these numbers are from 2016. But so as of 2016, 41.2 million Americans live in food insecure households, and food insecure means that not that you're starving necessarily, but that you don't have you're not sure that you're going to be able to put food on the table. You know, something that basic that day. Including 28.3 million adults and 12.9 million children. 12% of households, 15.6 million households are estimated to be food insecure. This is a major national crisis. I mean, it's kind of shocking to me. I mean, I understand why, but it's, you know, morally shocking that this isn't, you know, like a top political issue in the news on the lips of politicians every day.
Absolutely, it should be. And especially you point out the millions of children. So even if you're some very diehard free marketer, pro-capitalist, you know, economist, children surely don't deserve to go hungry. They aren't able to work. They didn't, you know, ask to be born, so to speak, and they exist suddenly in this world. They can't defend for themselves. They're utterly dependent on their families and the society around them. And, you know, certainly wouldn't accuse them of being lazy or being unengaged with the workforce. And yet they're hungry. And I think it's really important to talk about that food insecure, because food insecure means you don't know where your next meal is coming from. I mean, can you imagine that? You not knowing, well, maybe I'll get dinner tonight, maybe I won't. Hopefully I'll get breakfast the next day if I miss dinner.
In the United States, the richest country in the world.
Exactly. And, you know, we always characterize other countries as being, you know, plagued by famines and shortages. And yet here, that's precisely what's happening. Our kids are going hungry. The same way kids go hungry in other countries that we look down our nose at. Being food insecure, it isn't just about the physical costs, although those are significant. It's also the sociological and psychological costs, the insecurity of knowing where your next meal comes from. How can you plan for college? How can you plan for the test that you're going to have in a week? How can you plan long term for retirement or job, you know, acquiring a decent job when you're just focused on where is my next meal coming from? And you have kids that grow up in this environment for years. And of course, naturally, you have a population that is used to just scraping by and that isn't used to being taken care of or bettering themselves because they don't have that opportunity. So this has serious social consequences as well beyond just the obvious physical ones. And yet, with our 2.5 billion pounds of meat, we could absolutely start to make a dent in these things. I obviously can't do the math to know exactly how many people that would feed for how long. But the fact of the matter is, this is just a small part of our productive capacities. These meat processing plants could do far more billion pounds of meat if they want to. They just haven't because they don't believe they'll be able to sell it. And that's a fundamental problem.
I was reading about a story or a phenomenon that kind of incorporates aspects of the two stories that we've talked about so far about the crisis of elder care and this extreme overproduction of 2.5 billion pounds of meat that's just sitting in warehouses. About 2 in 5 homes in the United States are owned by, you know, so-called like baby boomers. So people who are getting older, are retired. And, you know, when people retire, they sometimes pretty frequently move out of their home, right? They downsize, they go to another, you know, they get an apartment maybe, or maybe they move somewhere else, they move to be closer to family, or they move into elder care facilities themselves. So what this article was arguing is that we're on the precipice of a major oversupply, quote unquote, of the housing market, that when baby boomers start to unload these large homes that they don't need in their older years, there's going to be so many homes on the market that the price of housing or the price of houses will collapse or will, you know, go down significantly. And that'll cause major problems for the economy. Now, again, you know, just like with the 2.5 billion pounds of meat, you could just give it to people who need food. With this housing, you could just give it to people who need housing. But that's not how this economy is structured.
Exactly. How it's structured is houses are not made for living in. They're made for speculative investments. They're made for profit, right? And that's actually the vast majority of companies and people that own homes are speculating on them. So rather than little single family homes, many, many housing is owned by hedge funds and private equity firms that are speculating on them and that are trying to make money. And they're not interested in giving people homes. They're interested in turning a profit. It just so happens that that providing homes in exchange for rent is profitable. I certainly hope that prediction is somewhat true. Certainly the housing market in all these major metropolitan areas, I'm in the Bay Area, is insanely expensive, is destroying communities because people can't find a place to live. And I would love to see the bubble burst significantly to where normal working people can afford to live in this community. That being said, I believe that financial firms will continue to dump money into the housing market, will continue to offer outsized prices to families that are considering downsizing as they're retiring so that they can buy those pieces of property and renovate them as condos, knock them down, build multi-unit structures so that they can rent them out to people, and really create a society of renters where we'll have a small group of landowners and a whole lot of renters that don't actually own the land that they're on. It's a lot like feudalism, honestly. I think that's more likely than having some huge major crash, but certainly that would benefit a lot of people who are unable to afford housing or barely able to afford housing.
Let's take another topic now. This is from the New York Times. Decade after crisis, a $600 trillion market remains murky to regulators. This is about the derivatives market. Derivatives is probably a term that our listeners have heard before, but many people, I mean, really, honestly, myself included, couldn't really explain what a derivative is. Do you want to take a shot at that?
Absolutely. So a derivative is hard to understand because it's completely made up. And that seems a little contradictory to anyone who's thinking about it. What a derivative is a financial instrument that a financial institution creates out of thin air and is tied to a real, quote unquote, a real price in the, quotes, real world. So a derivative on top of gold goes up and down based on the price of gold. And because derivatives are made up, you can also have derivatives that do the reverse, derivatives that go up in value as gold goes down in value and vice versa. And the main reason derivatives were created was supposedly to give these different investment firms kind of insurance policies against loss. So if you were gambling on the price of gold and hoping that it goes up and up and up, you could also protect your investment by taking out some derivatives that go up in price when the price of gold goes down. And it would be a way of kind of lessening the blow if it turns out that your speculative investment was wrong and gold actually crashed and you started losing money. So derivatives became huge during the last housing boom in 2008, as all these different companies took out derivatives to sort of protect their investments if there was some kind of housing market downturn. And one of the biggest issuers of those derivative forms of insurance was AIG, which some of our listeners may have heard of, which received the largest bailout and really just collapsed and was completely financially insolvent and had to be bailed out to the tune of billions of dollars. AIG had tons of derivatives on the housing market where they would pay out if the housing market went down. Well, boy, did it go down, and they weren't able to pay out. They ran out of money. Why this article matters is derivatives are extremely complex and very complicated things to understand. Even Alan Greenspan, who was the head of the Fed at the time, said that, you know, a math PhD couldn't understand some of this stuff and that he didn't understand a lot of it himself. And what this article is talking about is how this derivatives market is largely opaque and unseen and hidden by these various investment firms such as Goldman Sachs to regulators. So regulators aren't able to understand or see derivatives traded by these institutions outside the U.S. Well, as you can imagine, most of these institutions have offshore accounts in, you know, places like the Cayman Islands and other places, tax havens, that are not within the U.S. and therefore invisible to regulators. This is a huge problem because 2008 happened in part because regulators had no visibility into the housing market and the derivatives market that was being built. And right now there's approximately $600 trillion, although it's hard to know the number because, again, we're not allowed to see it, that is offshore and invisible to regulators. So really what this is a repeat of roughly 10 years ago where these complicated financial instruments are hidden from public eye, are hidden from regulatory eyes, and are really kind of time bombs need to happen because we're just going to have to trust that Goldman Sachs and the rest of them know how to manage these correctly and aren't taking undue risks. And we'll just have to take their word for it because we don't have visibility.
Right. Yeah. It's a pretty remarkable gamble to make. So the derivative market is so popular among these big banks because what we would traditionally think of as productive investment is not profitable, right? So, you know, you were saying, well, derivatives are just made up. I mean, that sounds weird that there could be a $600 trillion fictional market. But, you know, if you don't like the actual economy that exists producing goods and services, just make up your own, right?
Absolutely. I mean, think of gambling in a casino. You're not actually producing anything, right? You're not making shoes or food that you're selling to people. What you're doing is you have money and it's being shuffled around between different people who own the money based on odds, right? And if you're really good at predicting those odds, boy, you can take away a lot of money from some other people. And if you're not, you can lose a whole lot of money. But there's nothing productive about it. Yet I could walk into a casino and if I'm real lucky and real good, walk out with more money. And I've quote unquote made money. But I made money without actually making anything. I haven't produced a good or a service that people want. This is extremely attractive to financial institutions. They don't have to hire people. They don't have to open factories. They don't have to process goods or commodities. No, they don't have to do any of that. What they can do is create a speculative market, a gambling market, where other very wealthy firms and wealthy individuals gamble against one another. And when Goldman Sachs says, oh, we profited $45 billion in our derivatives market, what that also means is we took $45 billion from other investors who weren't able to gamble as well as we were. They lost, they made bad bets, and we won. That's exactly what we're seeing right here. And so it doesn't benefit society. It doesn't produce jobs. It doesn't produce things we need. And yet it produces more money than any industry out there to this day. And that's a huge problem. And it's also why it's incredibly unstable, because it's not tied to something in the real world, like the price of orange juice or shoes or something like that. It's tied purely to speculation and to gambling, which is an extremely unstable form of financial structure.
And the big banks can actually just get computers to do this, right? I mean, you're saying, you might have to have a mathematics PhD, or Alan Greenspan was saying that, or somebody with a mathematics PhD wouldn't necessarily understand how derivatives work. Well, you could just program a highly complex, financial technology, piece of software. And, even though most of the people who are being mechanized out of a job are, working class people, low wage people, there's actually a trend of layoffs in these big banks on Wall Street because you can just get computers to run these odds for you.
Absolutely. It is something that's highly automatable. They can create these very complicated trading algorithms that have thousands of rules in terms of when they trade, how much. And yes, many brokers are getting laid off. The commodities floor is something that some of our listeners might be used to from different movies, like Trading Places or something like that.
Trading Places. Yep.
Exactly. That's actually a fantastic way to understand how insider trading and trading works. I encourage anyone to watch that final scene where the kind of good guys rip off the millionaires. It's actually very informative.
Barron's newspaper, I guess it is, which is owned by the Wall Street Journal, says exactly the same thing. Even though it's a hilarious comedy, it's meant to be a comedy. You can learn more about commodities trading in the last 15 minutes of that movie than you can reading a textbook on it.
It's absolutely true. I would really encourage anyone to check it out. It's a fun movie anyway. But they have that scene where all these commodities traders are screaming at each other and waving tickets and yelling on the floor, and there's people filling orders. That doesn't actually exist anymore. That's all been automated. All those people are now unemployed, or at least in employment different than commodities trading. And this is coming for a lot of brokers. So, these firms are heartless. They'll happily lay off highly paid trading professionals and executives if a robot does a better job. And as things progress, robots are doing much, much better jobs. But it's totally unproductive labor, and it does really nothing to benefit society except create these extremely oversized paychecks by stealing money from other less sophisticated wealthy people who didn't trade quite as well as you did. One of the after effects too of it is this concentration of economic power, because if you're out there gambling and out there beating other traders, you're going to make more money. And the more money you have, the easier it is to outbid other people. So what you see is this concentration of wealth in the hands of very few through these trading mechanisms. So, that's how capitalism works. There's winners and losers. The losers get their lunch eaten by the winners, and the winners get bigger. And what that means is this huge concentration of wealth and financial power in a very small group of trading firms, which is growing smaller by the day.
In about our last 5 minutes, I want to turn to one final topic, and that's the case of Portugal. A facet of the 2008 global financial crisis is what people sometimes refer to as the European debt crisis, which really ballooned out a couple years after the main Wall Street meltdown. And as a consequence, a lot of the more economically fragile countries of the Eurozone, the countries that use the euro common currency, that's sort of, a main feature of the European Union project, they were put into these bailout programs. They were referred to as bailout programs, where they were given a large sum of money to pay back their creditors, right? So this is money that went to the big banks. And in return, they had to agree to these extreme austerity packages that could involve cutting budgets, removing or weakening labor regulations, doing all sort of like a wish list of the big corporations. But Portugal is one of those countries that were economically fragile and had to enter, a memorandum, a bailout program. But they've gone a different direction over the past year or two. Why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah, they went a very different direction. And we can't really overstate how much the 2008 crisis hurt Europe. They're still reeling from it, and they're still trying to resolve it. Portugal made a stand in 2015 to say, you know what, no more of these austerity measures, because they are extremely harsh. And we can see in many European countries, the economy is failing and growing weaker under this austerity program, which is supposedly supposed to create growth. What they did is they reversed the cuts to the wages of the various workers. They reversed the cuts to pensions and Social Security. And then they offered government incentives to different businesses to try to stimulate them to produce more. And ultimately what they found was this created a dramatic U-turn in their economy. And they went from this kind of worsening cycle of austerity, of poverty, to a much more virtuous cycle where consumer confidence is up, where buying is up, and where the economy is starting on an upward swing. I think really Portugal realized something that mainstream economists constantly overlook or choose to forget. And that is that your workers are also your consumers. So if you're going to cut wages to workers, you're going to make your consumers less able to buy what you're selling. So you're going to hurt your profits. And it's this fundamental contradiction in the kind of system how we have set up right now. Well, Portugal realized that and said, hey, I bet if we let our workers have a little extra, they'll also spend a little extra on the various businesses and the businesses will do well. And what do you know? That's what we see happening here. It's a very iconoclastic and countercultural way of doing things in the Eurozone right now. But we can't deny that we have this real world example where those policies are really benefiting people. Unfortunately, the dominant narrative is that we need to cut wages to workers because times are tough. We need to tighten our belts. But the more we do that, the more we'll destroy any sort of market of consumers and the more businesses are going to lose profitability. And it's just a cycle. They lose profitability. They cut wages. People buy less. They lose profitability. They cut wages. People buy less and so on and so forth. And their needs, Portugal showed that by stimulating workers, by giving them bonuses to their paychecks, to their pension plans, to their social security, that they can actually reverse that trend and start creating health in the economy again.
And it's an interesting political constellation that brought that together too. So the government is led by the Socialist Party of Portugal, which is, you know, like a social democratic, you know, not quite as left wing as like, say, Jeremy Corbyn, for instance, but maybe, you know, certainly to the left of like the Democratic Party in the United States, for instance. And they don't have a majority in parliament themselves. They rely on two smaller but more radical left wing parties, the Left Bloc and the Communist Party of Portugal, for their parliamentary majority. So it's kind of this interesting arrangement where, you know, the more moderate left-wing party is propped up by the more radical left-wing party for, you know, a very specific and limited end, which is to bring about the end of this, the cycle you were talking about, you know, the extreme austerity and hardship cycle that the Portuguese working class had been trapped in for several years. You know, that's, of course, that's not the ultimate goal of those smaller radical parties, but it is kind of an interesting tactical and strategic decision.
Yeah, I think it's really important. It shows that at least right now, these different parties are really listening to the needs of the working people of Portugal and really responding to them. It's exciting to see how even these simple reforms, which are well within the constellation of capitalism and private property, can benefit people so significantly, and how these strategic kind of partnerships, when they're done in the right way, when they're done with working people in mind, can really have some serious benefit to them. It also shows a kind of break in this extremely divided partisan political constellation that's in Europe and the rest of the world, where these groups are absolutely unwilling to cooperate with each other, constantly try to sabotage and undermine each other. And we have this instance where the message of the left and the communist parties was sufficiently loud enough and sufficiently popular enough with the population that the center left felt compelled to push in this direction and start taking on these important reforms.
We're going to leave it there. We've been joined from San Francisco by Daniel Sankey. He is a financial policy analyst. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, Community Public Radio. .org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.